CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world. Financial perspectives for tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, would you like to introduce our sponsors?
Absolutely. Today's show is brought to you by Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure.
And this week's newscast comes from CFO Magazine. So much for death by committee. Scrutinizing a routine cash management issue is just one of the new items on the top of audit committee's agendas these days. As companies across all industries reassess their risk appetites, their audit committees are conducting similar self-evaluations and often reordering the priorities they deem worthy of their worry. That has resulted in broader mandates, more discretion in agenda setting, and many more questions for company executives, particularly CFOs. If you'd like to hear more about that article, please log on to CFO.com. Well, today our guest is Craig Monahan, joins us today to discuss the role of the CFO. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Oh, thank you, Lorraine.
Well, Craig, you are Chief Financial Officer and Senior Vice President at Asbury Automotive Group, one of the largest automotive retailers in the United States. And I'm reading here, make sure I get my facts right. You operate 100-plus franchises at more than 80 dealership locations. Previously, you served as CFO at Sears, AutoNation, and iVillage, which you helped take public in 1999. Prior to that, you were with Reader's Digest, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and General Motors. You've got a degree in industrial engineering from Lehigh University and an MBA from Wharton. You started your career in the U.S. Army and rose to become captain. So let's start at the beginning. What lessons did you learn for being a CFO about being in the Army?
Well, I think the big benefit of a military background is that the military gives tremendous responsible people very early in their careers. For me, I was fortunate to be given a platoon on the DMZ in Korea, which was a phenomenal experience. And then later on in my military career, I worked as an aide-de-camp to a general officer. So I'm not sure there's anywhere else in the world that you can get that kind of responsibility when you're in your early 20s. What did I learn? I think there are a number of important learnings. You learn to lead by example. You learn to communicate well. You learn to the importance of teamwork. You learn to get things done in very difficult situations, and look at what our people today in Iraq and Afghanistan have to go through. But most importantly, I think you learn that the only real crisis is a crisis where someone's life is at risk.
Wow, that's very telling. Firstly, let me say thank you for being part of the country's U.S. Army and leading. You most certainly are a distinguished leader in our community, and it's very key for me to hear you say, leading by example, you're known for that. So kudos to you. Part of the reason that we actually have CFO Radio is so that the CFOs that are doing a very commendable job can actually talk about why they are a CFO, what brought you to this place. So you didn't start as that typical CPA, go down the audit path, go check off the tick boxes and so forth. Why did you choose the path to the CFO?
That's a great question. My path is unusual in some ways, but in other ways, I don't really think that it is. I mean, if we look at my background, I attended college on an ROTC scholarship. So there starts the military background. As you said, I was in engineering for 4 years, and I was in engineering, then I spent 4 years in the military and went back and got an MBA. But I think if we look at the role of a CFO, I mean, I believe what a company needs is a problem solver, someone who's a thinker, and probably ultimately someone who's a leader. And those skills can be developed, I think, in any number of career paths, and not necessarily you've got to be an accountant and a CPA. The role is much, much broader than that. I think with the advent of Sarbanes-Oxley and all the problems before that, there was clearly a shift in emphasis to people who had much more of the accounting and control backgrounds. I think that pendulum is beginning to swing back. And I think if we could talk to a board or a CEO and say, what is it that you really want out of a CFO? They're going to say they want someone who's a leader and someone who's a business partner. And again, that can come from many different paths of life.
Interesting that you say that. There was a national survey, and as I speak, I'm forgetting by whom it was, and we'll attach it to the CFOradio.com slot for the listeners to be able to click into. But it indicated that CEOs that were surveyed, I think it was over 1,000 CEOs that were surveyed, and it indicated what would you like your leader to be, and it also included board level as well. And they said, number one, trustworthy. Mm. So the whole communication and leading by example, it's very much there. And obviously in today's world, being in finance, we've got to do the right thing. We've got to add up the right numbers. The challenge is you're getting information and data perhaps from people you've not yet even met in a country or a location that you've not actually yet been to. So therein lies one of the fun challenges of being a CFO. Now, that being said, you've served in some very senior roles also at publicly held companies. Tell us, if you would, a little bit about some of those early experiences where you were starting out, the analyst, the accountant, and so forth. What was your first role, and what did it teach you?
That's a great question. My first role in finance, and again, this is after I've left the Army and spent some time in graduate school, was in the treasurer's office, General Motors Treasurer's Office in New York City. I spent other time in other large organizations as well, as we discussed, and I've also done a dot-com. So I feel like I've been very fortunate to see both large organizations and small organizations, and there are pros and cons to both, if I were to look back. Large organizations can be fantastic training grounds because they've got the infrastructure and the wherewithal to do that. And if you're in a large organization, there's usually also a fairly clear path, a career path that you will be expected to follow, and you can pretty much get a sense for how am I doing. On the other hand, I would say smaller companies can also be very exciting. I think it's a different environment, clearly can also be a lot of fun. It's one, I would say, they tend to be much less political. In a small organization, the results are very obvious. So I think people are much more rewarded for getting things done. But then again, one of the downsides is in a smaller organization, the career path can be much more ambiguous because it's not so clear that I do this and this and this and this, because those positions may not be available.
And I guess the roles are also somewhat ambiguous, in that you might be wearing, as a treasurer, the treasurer's hat today, but then if the CEO or CFO wants you to do something tomorrow, you might have the T-shirt on and be the rah-rah person.
That's so true, and I consider Asbury to be a small organization. Even though we do $4 billion in revenue and have roughly 7,000 employees today, we feel small to me. We're at the end of the day, we're a car store. But we ask our people to wear a lot of hats in this organization. And I say we're small because the headquarters group that runs that organization is probably 50 people or so. But our treasurer, he's the treasurer, he also does risk management, and he runs investor relations for us. The fellow that runs M&A for us is literally out looking for deals one day. He also runs procurement, and he takes care of all of our facilities. So it's a lot of hats, but you know, for the right people, it's a lot of fun. We're never bored. We always have exciting projects to work on. And what it would take me back to is, you know, as I look back, so what's it all about? I think as you start to think about your career, the challenging positions, and clearly these people are in challenging positions, are usually the most rewarding positions, and not necessarily because of the immediate compensation, but because of the personal development that comes with those challenges. And I would tell you, if I look at my career, the most important positions for me, you know, there were two. One was being a platoon leader, and two was being the CFO of iVillage. And I didn't make a whole lot of money in either one of those situations, but the experience was invaluable.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. I, in my career, had a lot of advantages because I was the one that wanted to progress. My husband would say it meant that he didn't see me sometimes, but at 9 and 10 o'clock at night, when the CFO walks down the hall and says, we're about to do such and such on an M&A deal, who can analyze this? And you're the only person sitting there. Go figure who gets the nice jobs, the tough jobs.
Right.
But to your point, it's often a challenge, but a compromise of that challenge creates personal development and opportunity.
Agreed.
So that being said, you mentioned iVillage. I'd like to talk a little bit about that. You took it public. Take us through some of the key steps in getting ready for the IPO, perhaps particularly when you're not used to the timelines of being in a public reporting situation.
I'd start with the answer to that question, back to your challenge point, which I think is so true, and it's a very personal decision. So I was sitting in a Fortune 500 company. I was treasurer and had a phone call, asked if I would like to go work at iVillage. And I decided to do so. I took a relatively significant pay cut to do that. But to me, the potential education was just phenomenal. For me, it was the chance to leave all of the secondary jobs, if you would, and become a CFO. You know, unfortunately, you know, but here come the challenges. The dot-com world was in a craze at the time. You know, I stepped into my new job, and I discovered we had enough cash to make 3 payrolls. I looked around. I was used to a sophisticated staff with people with different levels of experience. We had a staff that was extremely young. We were running websites, and our sites were going down on a regular basis. So we had IT issues as well. And it seemed that every day the business model changed. So you're almost in a blur, but
you're the CFO for an entrepreneur. And by the way, they also have a side habit of being ADD.
Exactly. But you know, at first it can be extremely intimidating. But I think once you accept, okay, this is it. Let's go for it, and let's see what we can make out of it. And my great takeaway there was, the whole key to success in so many things, and certainly in that environment, is attracting and retaining great people. The other thing I learned is that energy, enthusiasm, intelligence, and commitment can overcome very significant gaps in experience. And, you know, these young people got it done. I mean, many of them didn't have any idea what it took to close a month or produce a 10K or a 10Q, but we learned how to do it, and we were successful. I think there was one other thing you learn in that environment, and that is speed is a competitive advantage. And you enjoy it, and it's good.
You know, it's interesting. In my business, I'm often interviewing CFOs and talking to them about their career. And sometimes it's the controller or treasurer that aspires to be the CFO. And there might be a learning for that aspirational CFO, the CFO wannabe, in terms of first time you take on the job, be sure to read the financials and be sure to ask the people about the real financials, not the ones on the paper, because sometimes that's what it is. It's there's a newness to being that first-time CFO that maybe second time going to be the CFO, you'd do an awful lot more due diligence yourself, right?
Right, absolutely.
But good lessons learned. So talk to us a little bit about the process of going public, due diligence for you. Had you previously done due diligence in terms of that level for you of taking the financials to that level of next detail, to that level of next reporting, albeit for you, you didn't have to go SOX compliant immediately, but there's a level of control and if you will, a timeline commitment that now you have to abide by.
Yeah, so here you point to one of my weaknesses. So my background is engineering. Much of the work I had done earlier was international and specifically in treasury for large multinationals. And here we are trying to take a company public and produce public financial statements, and I had no accounting background. So for me, the learning curve was as steep as it can get. Rather than lay out a detailed process of what you have to do to get public, I think...
were there any key highlights from it, perhaps?
Yeah, the key highlight for me was a very simple one. You can't go public unless you're prepared. So I go back to the Boy Scout motto. If you're thinking about going public, be prepared. because what hit us, and I'll never forget it, is that, you know, there was this rush to get public. There were a couple of places where we probably took a few shortcuts that maybe we shouldn't have. But we needed the funding. You know, we were, those businesses at that time were burning a lot of cash. The market was open. It was red hot. We did take a few shortcuts. And what I learned was catching up is hell. Mm-hmm. So everything has to be in place. And whether that's, you know, controls, management, reporting systems, budgeting, forecasting, financial planning and analysis, risk management, treasury, investor relations, we can go through the whole list. It all has to be in place, because once you're public, the spotlight's on, and before you know it, it's time for another quarterly earnings release.
Oh, yeah. And that comes around and bites you in the rear end pretty quickly, huh?
Very, very quickly.
Well, but also that's the fun of it, right? Now you've gone public. Now you get it. Okay, now we're in a quarterly. Now we're in a monthly. Now I'm the CFO, huh?
And I mean, especially with an IPO, I look back at us. When I joined, I said we didn't have a whole lot of cash on hand. So we went out and we raised some money privately at $6 a share. We were hoping to get public at 12. We were 30 times oversubscribed. So we went out at 25. We opened for trading at 80. And not long thereafter, we traded up to 130. But with that type of movement, there's tremendous scrutiny on the company, and you know, not all companies are going to see that. But then this was the height of the dot-com boom. But I think the lesson is still the same. Okay, now you're public. You've got a massive market cap. We had a $3 billion market cap. We're burning $25 million of cash a year, and people are paying a tremendous amount of attention to you, including not only your investors but the SEC and your other financial partners, your shareholders. You have to be prepared. There's no room for shortcuts.
It's interesting you mentioned the SEC, obviously publicly traded company. That's a big part of your world. I remember the days when you could actually pick up the phone and call the SEC for advice about your accounting policy. And those days are way gone.
Yes.
You've got to give your name, you've got to give your rank and serial number and your company name and all that. And then at that point, you really don't feel like you want to answer the question or ask the question. Well, what are the key challenges for you as a public company CFO? Is it the regulatory reporting?
For us, it's not. I mean, reporting is something that comes, that's just one of the many responsibilities of being a public company. And I think maybe I could give you a little more perspective on our company, and that might help with what
I say. Yeah, please do.
Why I say it's not. With the onset of the recession in the end of 2008, car sales, new car sales in this country dropped by about 40%. So we're right in the middle of that. So there go 40% of our new vehicle revenues. We were heavily indebted. We were put together by a number of private equity players, and debt was part of that program. So we've got this massive drop in revenue. We're heavily indebted. That stressed our balance sheet. We got a going concern opinion from our auditors. We're blowing covenants. This was not a good time. I mean, the fact of the matter is we had a brush with bankruptcy. Our debt had dropped to the point that it was trading at 40 cents, below 40 cents on the dollar, and our stock was a little over a dollar a share. So it was a pretty, pretty difficult time for our team, our company. But with a lot of hard work and tough decisions, we have 1,500 fewer associates today than we did in the beginning of 2008, and very timely decisions. I mean, it's kind of like back to the dot-com. You can't delay some of these decisions yet. We had to move very, very quickly.
You're the platoon leader again.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And you're in a hot spot. We had great partners, particularly our banks, who stepped up with us, and we got through it. And today I look at where we are, and where stock is now trading at almost $13 a share. Our debt trades above par. And really, the greatest challenge for us, back to your original question, is how do we grow profitably in a very uncertain business environment? I think we're back to the partnership, and where do we want to take the company as opposed to just, you know, worrying about reporting or one single element of what it means to be successful.
And therein lies, I think, an element of today's CFO and tomorrow's CFO. There used to be the auditor through the controller becomes the CFO. today's CFO has a broad business background. Today's CFO is out in the community meeting with the head of sales and the sales team, meeting with marketing, meeting with the people that produce the widgets, meeting with the people that go do the operations and the back office, like you said, the IT, the administration, the human resources, because of the control requirement, but also because you're fulfilling a financial reporting need that isn't the finances and the numbers. It's not bean counting. You're reporting information on the company. And if you don't get out into the company, you won't know what it is. And so many of our guests over the years have said to us, I'm much more of a reporting information person, but I'm also a business manager, business leader, and I have peers that I work with. And so 20, 30 years when I looked back on my career, I didn't do that. I sat in a desk in an office and I counted beans. So your role today is more broad?
Yeah, very much so. And I come back to the business partner theme. Yeah, sure, within the finance organization, we are providing this reporting, internal reporting, external reporting. But I sincerely believe we add value when we can help those folks in the store sell and service vehicles. And that means that we, myself included, and other people on our staff, have to be in the stores, not day to day, but they're the front line. But, back to the platoon leader. It's the sales manager or that technician, that are dealing with our customers. Every dime of revenue that we generate, comes from one of those folks out there on the front line. And our view is, our mission is very simple, and that is to help make them successful, because without them, we're nowhere.
Was there some learning from your iVillage days that perhaps now, knowing what the auto industry is becoming 20, 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, when you wanted to go buy a car, you went up to the store, you pulled up and you asked the person behind the counter, what cars have you got on the lot today? In today's world, I would imagine your customers have done an awful lot of internet research, perhaps takes you back to the iVillage days. They're probably much more knowledgeable than they were back when. Is that what you're finding?
Oh, absolutely. It's I would say today 90 to 95% of the customers who come into our stores have already done a substantial amount of research on the web. And our business, the car business, is changing, and it's changing rapidly. We are spending a tremendous amount of energy building new infrastructure, and technology infrastructure specifically, but it will not be long before the day gets here that on your iPhone, you will be able to get someone to give you a estimate for what your vehicle's worth. You will be able to take a look at all of our inventory. You will be able to pick out a car. You will virtually be able to get through the majority of the car buying process from that iPhone. It's the car buying process in many regards has been slow and cumbersome and uncomfortable for the consumer. That is changing very rapidly, and technology and the web is going to be on the leading edge of those changes. And that's one of the areas where we have to spend time and work very hard to improve the customer experience. And we, our finance team and our technology teams are very, very deep.
In your company, do you manage technology, or is there an equivalent peer at your level that does?
No, the IT function is part of the group that I work with on a day-to-day basis. In our organization today, we're in the midst of a very heavy structural rebuild of the IT department. We are putting in place for automotive retail what would be an ERP process, something like an SAP. Our stores have tended in the past to operate on a standalone basis, and now we're trying to really run as one company and take advantage of these technologies. So, for example, if you go online and look at a car here in Atlanta, it's an alley. We don't want to just show you the vehicles we have in inventory at the Lexus store. We want to have the opportunity to show you all of the vehicles that we have in this market, whether they be new or used, and make them immediately available, wherever you might be. So all that is Much of that is here today, but there's so much more to do.
Interesting that you say that's part of your team oversight. That's more and more frequently happening, that the CFO is managing other functions. That might be a component of the size of your business, but you're pretty sizable being at $4 billion. And what we're seeing more is that the CFO is managing technology functions, the information element, and that customer focus is also very, very relevant, the timeliness, the strictness with which you need to manage and oversee that. Very, very interesting. Well, what key challenges do you think you have for a company that would today possibly want to go public? Is it the debt, the financing, the funding, or maybe is it something else?
For today, I think I go back to where we were before. It's just that everything needs to be in place if you're going to go public. The capital markets are far more difficult today, but they're open. But you've got to have decent credit. I mean, we're seeing, in our stores, we're seeing more and more credit availability for our customers. We are very fortunate. We've got a lot of cash in the bank today. But we've got credit lines that are available to us. If we needed to go to the markets today for additional credit, it's there. So it's, you know, we've all been frightened here over the past 18 months or so about the credit markets. They're improving. I don't think that's what would stop necessarily a company that was in good shape from being public. I go back to more of the fundamentals. Is it a good business model? Do you have all those different components in place? And are you really ready for the scrutiny of being a public entity?
You know, interesting that you should say that. We talked with our guest from the last show in the scrutiny and the role of the CFO also being a speaker for the company, that CEOs and CFOs now today are actually signing up for comedy school in order that they can, you know, take the tomatoes or the bad eggs that come at them and be that for a training, right, of that investor relations, that going public, that speaking element, because now the communication is very much in the public's eyes. Mm-hmm. Well, kudos to you. You're now in a very positive, healthy cash position. That's fabulous. Well, Sarbanes-Oxley for many of us has been a very big impact. We've talked a little bit about the reporting. Talk to us a little bit about, we're many years into companies that have now become Sarbanes-Oxley compliant. Is this just a part of being routine?
It's very much become routine. Sarbanes-Oxley was put in place for a very good reason. I think at the end of the day, it is value added. I do think the pendulum swung too far. You know, my view would be that if we look at the WorldComs and the Enrons of the world and really examine where did they go bad, you know, they went bad in the CEO office. You know, it was the C-level suite where things broke down. I think one of the challenges with Sarbanes-Oxley was the response was a very heavy, very detailed set of requirements that happened at very much at the operating, very levels. So the problems at the highest level, the responses at the lowest level, and we had a little bit of, I think, I'm overweighting on that low-level response, and that's what we're starting to see corrected. And, you know, we do it now on a regular basis. I think the requirements are not quite as stringent from our perspective as they used to be, and I think we struck a pretty good balance.
That's very healthy. It's good to hear that. Well, something else that is potentially in that future tomorrow world, international accounting standards, the IFRS. Right now you're focused on a US market, but the cars that you are selling have a very international focus and a cost structure that is from those foreign markets. What do you see, and do you see any impact to you from those international markets and IFRS?
Yeah, it's really two different issues here, the accounting versus the international market. So from an accounting side, we're watching what's happening with IFRS. We believe, and I think many others would agree, that FASB is already moving in that direction. I think the most immediate impact we're feeling are these changes we're going to see with lease accounting, where essentially, you know, what was an operating expense and an off-balance sheet liability, it's going to move back onto the balance sheet and be basically reflected as debt. Having gone through some challenging times, we're accustomed to looking at leases as debt. And when we were under stress and working very closely with our banks, those leases were debt. There was no doubt about it. So I think what's happening is the world is ultimately catching up with the fact that a lease, a long-term lease, is debt and probably should be reflected as that, and we're ready to get there when the rest of the world gets there. With respect to your question about the markets, that's very interesting, especially in our world, where over 80% of our sales are either premium luxury vehicles or midline imports. So we're selling the BMWs, the Hondas, the Lexus, the Toyotas. And as the markets change and the currency values change, that does have a very direct impact on our business. And if you're in Germany producing a very high-end car and the market in the United States is weak and maybe the dollar feels like it's overvalued, they will redirect that production to another country, and we will see a shortage in inventory. Now, that shortage of inventory will also drive up prices, so there's somewhat of an offsetting impact, but it's a very dynamic world we live in, and even though we're today just a domestic retailer, we are part of a much bigger global market.
Just out of curiosity, do you think that there may be some future impact from the taxing authorities looking at those non-green cars, the high-end cars that you have? They run fast, they look sleek, they're great, but there's also a side element that they're not the little car that perhaps is the most efficient from a gas guzzling perspective.
That's very true, and some of those taxes already exist today. Certain of those cars over certain price points will be subject to an excise tax, if you will. So that's in place today. I can't predict where that goes tomorrow, but that's certainly a consideration.
Certainly, my family are all in the UK, and there's some pretty hefty taxes over there. I remember when I first came to the country 16, 17 years ago, a cost for me at that time in my life was how much you spend on gas. And gas prices are considerably higher in other countries than they are here. Taxes also are considerably higher on cars. So I think we're quite lucky that we are where we are, but let's fingers crossed that the balance is keeping there on that one. Let's talk a little bit, if we can, about the organization. As a platoon leader of your finance function, the workforce, the UX, is still experiencing a little bit of hard times. One of the side benefits is that the cost of bringing on an employee has perhaps reduced a little bit, but we've got a benefit cost potentially increasing every year that seems to flatten and stretch that number upwards, not downwards. Has any of the recent economic element on the workforce had any impact on you? In terms of the growth that you needed to go through, you've had some shrinkage, but now you're looking at that growth again.
Yeah, it's unfortunately the economy's had a huge impact on our workforce, and I mean in a number of ways. And if you look at our total workforce, is probably 20% smaller today than it was 2 years ago. Our corporate staff was reduced by a third. Our headquarters was located in New York 2 years ago. Today, here we are in Atlanta. And another move that was predominantly a cost savings move and a move to get us closer to the customer, back to we need to be near the front line. We eliminate our dividends, we slash capital spending. So when you're making those hard decisions that have a direct impact on our shareholders, our owners, we also were forced to make the hard decisions around the workforce. I guess where I come back, as we sit here today, we ended last quarter with about $100 million in cash. We've been able to recruit an outstanding team here in Atlanta. I mean, we couldn't be happier with the team that we've got in place. Because we are seeing some recovery in the car business. I mean, car sales dropped, like I said, dropped about 40%, but probably have recovered about 20% since then. So, we are seeing some strength. It is giving us the opportunity to do some hiring. And, today we're also looking at acquisitions. So if things aren't what they used to be, and just to give you an example, if we went back to 2007, this country was, and from 2000 through actually part of 2008, this country was selling about 17 million new cars a year. Today we're selling about 11.5 million new cars a year. So it's not anywhere close to what it was, but it's a whole lot better than it was when the recession started and we were only selling 9.5 million cars. But we've made the adjustments in the organization. We're profitable. We're generating cash. And, while we're not having a party, things do feel a whole lot better. And I would say they almost feel pretty good.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Over the last 6 months, our guests on the radio show have talked to us about that funding being more accessible, the capital markets slightly opening, the capability for them to now look at acquisitions. Our last guest talked about 3 acquisitions in the last 15 months. We're seeing more movement. That growth is going to spur hiring more in the workforce, and that is also going to have more people with more money in the pockets to go buy the new cars, right?
Right, absolutely.
Go buy the BMW and the other cars that you guys sell. Mm. What impact does worldwide sourcing, if any, have on your role? And the reason that I ask this question is you go to your lawyer today, very often there might be an outsourced element of someone doing research in India or Argentina or something like that. You go to your CPA firm now, they've got somebody in a different country doing the research, techno-babble stuff, mm-hmm. and getting back to you. And we all know about the outsourcing of billing and so forth. Have you as a company looked at any of that? Has it impacted you at all?
We have not pushed any of our work offshore. We do outsource. We typically, so we'll outsource to a vendor. Now, they may well outsource offshore. But that is, that has not been an area that we felt has been a big opportunity for us to this point. We sell and service cars. I just keep coming back. That's what we do. It's here in the United States. That's where our focus is. Any of the support that we need to do that we can ask a third party to do, we're more than happy to do so. And we do know that those partners that we work with are doing just that, the global outsourcing.
Interesting. Keep to the core. Know what you do best. Go do it again.
Right.
Leadership in relation to companies involves leading people, involving leading processes, and involves leading systems. Let's talk a little bit, if we can. You alluded a little bit ago about systems and the role that you play in managing the information technology function. How has your role, as you look back over the years of being in the finance function, changed, and specifically in relation to information systems? Has that impact had a development on your role in your organization?
Yeah, it's it's funny you should ask. And as you asked this question, I was just thinking, I've been involved with IT ever since I've been almost ever since I've been a CFO. And the way it started for me was back at iVillage. So I joined to be the CFO and take the company public. I was probably there 2 months, and we had a very serious crash of our websites. I mean, here we are at .com and our websites are down. And our CEO came to me and said, in addition to your day job, you're now also responsible for IT. So if my head was spinning, it was now spinning twice as quickly. But it was a tremendous opportunity. My background's engineering, although I'm not in fact, industrial engineering is a little bit of systems engineering. But I'm not an IT geek.
You even knew what binary was, huh? You had to fit
up. I did know what binary was. Her request just threw me right into the middle of it. And now rather than having just one floor to run around on where we had all the financial types, I could go one floor down where all the IT types were. And, in those days it was Nerf footballs flying back and forth and people squeezed elbow to elbow on the, piece of plywood laying across a filing cabinet.
Wearing jeans and T-shirts,
and you hope they had shoes on, which was not always the case. But
and you know what? They give us a bad rep too.
Yeah, I love the IT organizations. The there are, we go back to thinkers, you know, they're bright people there, they're thinkers, they're always trying to do something better, you know, faster. I think we believe as an organization, they carry tremendous responsibility for the success of any organization. I mean, they, to a large extent, drive our ability to improve productivity. They have a direct impact on our customers' experience, on our employees' experience, and ultimately how much profitability we can drive. So it's an absolutely critical function. These are not just people who enable reports. These are people who make us better.
Interesting that you say that, because I certainly remember 25, 26, something like that, years ago when I was writing my thesis, I actually wrote it on implementing accounting systems. It was a IBM System 36 that I was replacing with a System 38 with 6 terminals. Mm-hmm. Wireless wasn't even invented, but there was a very long wire between the 6 terminals. That was a big deal. Look where we are today. Yeah. You're talking about the customer experience being impacted by the technology function. And perhaps maybe more importantly in your business, I as a customer go in to buy a car, and if the manager with whom I'm speaking can't pull up a credit report of the system, there's no sale.
No. And it's a great example. So in our industry, traditionally, if you walked into a car dealership to buy a car, it may take you 2 hours. And why is it going to take so long? Well, there may be 7 or 8 different systems that we've got to go through. You know, we need to go to one system and figure out, well, what's your trade-in worth. We have to go to another system, and we need to get your credit bureau. We may have to go to another system or 2 or 3 to figure out, you know, is there a bank? You know, what bank do we want to try to get the funding lined up on? We've got to go to another system and see, what inventory do we have in stock? Do we have the options that you want? And I could go on and on. I mean, when you dig into it, there are a lot of steps that happen in this process, and it's one of the reasons it drags out so long. With technology, you know, we look at that and go, why can't it be half an hour? And if that customer has taken that time back on that iPod, they know what they want, why can't we just tell them, well, here's the price of the vehicle, here's what your trade-in's worth, and why can't you come into that store, pick up your vehicle, being gone 15 minutes? And rather than handing you a stack of papers that could be 20 or 30 different documents, why don't we just email it back to you? There are a lot of things that we can do to make the customer's life better and make our employees' life better. And so now an employee who would have been tied up for 2 hours on that sales process, if we're done in 15 minutes or 30 minutes, they're on to the next customer as well. So they have an opportunity to be more productive, I think have a much more enjoyable job, and make more money.
Does that create your role as managing the IT function much more critical on the risk and contingency planning of, oh my gosh, the system doesn't come up this morning, we've got the entire workforce can't sell a car?
Oh, yeah, we have. In my career, I've had that situation where we've pushed technology a little too far, and we think everything's working, and then in a car store, the big rush is on Saturday morning. And Saturday morning, here came the rush. There went the system. And people are using papers and pencils to try to sell cars.
And probably there went the customer too, right?
Well, we do have fallback. We used to sell cars with paper and pencil, and we can do it again if we have to, but that's not a good thing. So in my mind, in the IT world, we have two ends of the spectrum to cover. As we say, we have to keep the lights on. So the system has to run. It has to be timely. It can't bog down. We need to be able to find out what vehicles are in stock. But I would say that's only half of the IT job. The other half of the IT job is asking that hard question of, what does the future hold? You know, how can we be better? Where's the world going? And it's a very much a web-based question.
Do you almost have an innovation think tank situation or an innovation leader within your technology function that would project those needs?
I think I'd answer that and say we've got...
Or do your customers just tell you, hey, I want this?
Well, we have the other thing we've got going for us is we have 80 general managers out there running stores, and I kind of think of them as platoon leaders as well. And they don't hesitate to tell us, you know, what they believe is the future. Again, these are the men and women on the front line. They're interacting with the customers. And we all see what other retailers are doing. We don't try to just learn what's happening in automotive retailer. I mean, we walk into a Best Buy and say, wow, look what these guys are doing. And why can't we do that? We just want to be better, 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 better. And anybody is welcome to challenge us to do that. We encourage it.
I like how you think. Dangerous place to be. Well, we talk also of forecasting. You've talked about the future, the tomorrow, the capital markets picking up and so forth. Clearly forecasting. Forward-looking statements, to quote a phrase, forecasting and so forth. What do you do in your business that helps you really drive that bottom line? You've talked about getting better, being faster, being more efficient. Obviously, a component of your role is also the profitability. You talked very much about that being key. Are there specific tools you use that have brought you a specific ability to analyze or deep dive and then analyze some more?
Yeah, that's there are tools we use. I wish I could tell you that they're sexy. They're not. They're basically Excel.
Yeah, Bill Gates doesn't realize he's got one of the best accounting packages out there.
This recession taught us a lot. And I think one of the things that it taught us, and I'll be the first to admit, and that is that we do not have a crystal ball. So we could forecast to our heart's content, and we'll still be wrong. And I will tell you that the speed and severity of this downturn was something that none of us, and I say none of us in our company and none of us in our industry, would have ever forecast.
Took us all by surprise.
Absolutely. I mean, we would, I think as an industry, we would say, well, if car sales fall to 12 million units, remember we're at 17, if they fell to 12 million units, that's as bad as it could get because it would be the end of the world. Well, now we dream of the day when car sales get back to 12. So we're humbled, if you would. And with that humility, I think what it's meant to our forecasting is we do a lot of forecasting. We're forecasting the state of the business at least twice a month. You know, where do we think the current period's running? In addition to that, we'll do other long-term forecasts. They're basically all Excel-based. It's a very powerful tool, especially to where it's advanced today. What we will do frequently is multiple scenarios. We don't just do one scenario when we're doing a forecast. We're doing upside, best case, downside. And then after we get it done, you know, could be a week later, we're doing another one. I mean, we're constantly trying to have a sense of where the world might be. I would say that bottom line, our planning philosophy is to be prepared for a continued weak economy. But to have plans in place to respond once we see signs of sustained improvement. So it's kind of prepare for the worst, be ready if it gets a little bit better.
Kind of platoon leader 101, right?
It's basic. The only other thing I'd add to it is that we spend a tremendous amount of time benchmarking. So with respect to objectives, with our competitors. There are five other publicly traded large automotive retailers. And at every quarter when everybody's financial results come out, we have a series of matrices where we just fill them up and we grade ourselves. And in fact, our compensation system is built on that as well. Our bonuses are driven in part by where we rank versus our peers. So,
that's
very, very, very good system.
Yeah.
And keeps everybody very highly motivated.
I'll say, yeah, that really is quite progressive. You know, one of the other companies that I've got to know a little bit more, and in fact, a call out to them, we'd love them to be on the radio show too, is Georgia Pacific. And they have taken the model that you're just describing one step further, and every employee in the company needs to have their own P&L and balance sheet. And if they don't shift the needle of value to be an improvement, they don't get a pay rise. Or perhaps I'm misspeaking, they don't get a bonus, mm-hmm. I think is how it speaks. And that's very, very progressive. But to your point, what you're describing is very progressive. And there's an element that you can't control your competitors, but you sure as heck can control you.
Yes, yes.
That takes us on to risk. Future looking, control, what you can control. And in my youth, what I used to call controllable costs and out of controllable costs takes us into risk management, mm-hmm. contingency planning. Talk to us a little bit about risk management for you as CFO today.
Risk for us is everywhere, just like it is for everyone else. Right now, if you would, we've come through the crisis or through the storm, and we are now going through another enterprise risk strategy review. It's being led by the head of our internal audit team, but it involves all of our senior management team. We view risk as a shared responsibility. It's everywhere. As you say, there are risks you can manage and risks you can't. But what we try to do, kind of goes back to the forecasting a little bit, is every decision we make, we want to understand how good can it be, how bad can it be, is this a risk we want to manage, or is this a risk that we want to try to hedge or push off to somewhere else? You can never escape it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of never being able to escape it, unfortunately, we can't escape the end of the show. I have one last question for you. We've got a tradition to ask our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? What's yours?
It's a great time to buy a new car. And we need to go out there and do it and get this economy back on track.
That is hilarious. To all our guests out there, please go buy a car, but not from one of the competitors, right?
If you're here in Atlanta, Nally.
Well, thank you to Craig for being our guest today. It's been a pleasure for hearing you sharing your innermost thoughts. You've been very open, and we appreciate that. Thank you to our contributors, CFO Magazine, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses. For more information, please go to www.delaneyllc.com. And thanks also to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small and medium-sized companies. For more information, please go to www.sap.com. This and other thought leadership about today and tomorrow's CFO is available from cforadio.com. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.